Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. Good. I've been given a briefing by Asaf about that you are a mixed group, that some of you are part of the DFP program and some of you are not. So I have no clue who is and who isn't, or even if that matters or not. Well, I would like to address something of a topic that I'm sure is of relevance. It consists of various parts. One part has to do with relationship in general. One part has to do with community and its relevance, and what brings about community and what stops community. Another part is what the relationship of the individual to something called Sangha, or the concept of Sangha. I sense there is some relevancy in this, particularly in Israel. But not just in Israel. I've been here a couple of weeks, and I've had the occasion to meet people here in Tel Aviv, and then I was in Ein Karem, and I have a very superficial understanding of what's going on in this country. But in many ways, it resembles other Western countries I have more familiarity with, and one of them is the emergence of Buddhist communities. Sometimes these Buddhist communities are not actually communities, they're big heaps of Buddhist individuals. And that's one of the big differences between a community and a heap of individuals. And it seems to be that Buddhism is attractive to people who are good at being individuals. I don't know how it looks in your biography. In my biography, Buddhism wasn't really a trend when I started being attracted by it some 25 years ago. In fact, it was marginal. It was slightly freaky. Nowadays, Buddhists find themselves, I don't know how it is in Israel because I can't read Hebrew, I don't know the popular press, but in Europe, Buddhism gradually has made its way into lifestyle. You know, it's something in between wellness and lifestyle. There is something very nice about this. If you can open women's magazines and articles about Buddhism in there. At the same time, it has something slightly disturbing about being moved suddenly from a challenging world religion that, you know, is deeply subversive to some of the cherished and held values in material society, to being suddenly a trendy lifestyle fashion statement. You know, there's something slightly disturbing about this. I think we just have to put up with this. Right now in Europe and in America, Buddhism has its heyday. You know, the popular media are enchanted by Buddhism, particularly by Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama and Richard Gere and who and what not, you know. There will be a time this honeymoon will be over. I am in no doubt that one day this popular honeymoon of Buddhism, or a type of Buddhism that has made it into popular mind, will be over. I think we shouldn't concern ourselves too much with this. I personally appreciate the fact that that I can speak about Buddhist things and be a Buddhist in places I never have dreamt of being able to speak as a Buddhist. And I think there is something very useful in this, in a lowered suspicion threshold in the popular mind. Yeah. I don't think that really addresses the task Buddhist practitioners have. Much of what I experience Buddhist practitioners to be strong individuals. Buddhism is something that seems to respond to an individualistic understanding of the world. You see, when Western people went to Asia and began to encounter Indian teachings, and in particular Buddhist teaching, if you look at back the last 100 years, you see that they kept seeing different things in Buddhist teaching. The first Western accounts are strongly tinged by romanticism. The rational age had just dawned in the West, beginning of the 20th century, and some of the people were fed up with a rational understanding of world. And so when they went to Asia, or when they picked up on Asia, generally it was scholars with the Greek, Latin Greek linguistic background, they found something in the Buddhist teaching that responded to their need to not be rational. Yeah. So you have whole waves of... and then 20 years later, you have people who come from Asia, educated Sri Lankan people, who looked onto the Western world as more progressed. They tried to sell their own Buddhism, the religion of their mothers and fathers, which they have become slightly estranged by their Western education. They tried to make Buddhism look very reasonable. So as from the 1920s onwards, you have really seriously reasonable Sri Lankan Buddhism. You know, Buddhism is a science, Buddhism is logical, Buddhism is perfectly based on empiric understanding. And then you have other people. You have the Germans who go out there and find, obviously, philosophy. So, you have great... People pick up on the mystic aspect of Buddhism. And then my particular brand, the people where, which have influenced me more, this is obviously the 60s. You know, I was born 60. So, the people who picked up on the Buddhist practice. You know, Buddhism is meditation. The really big thing about Buddhism is its contemplative tools. It is that which allows us to actually understand the mind. It's not something you have to believe. It's not something you have to reason methodically. It's not some kind of weird cult you have to join. It reconciles reason with faith. And one way of doing this, it allows you to actually change the way you are with yourself by meditating. That was a big insight I had, that meditation allows you to exactly be as you are without having to enact what you are. Yeah? It is possible to hold an experience rather than to have it. No. It's possible to experience a difference between the content of my mind and becoming the content of my mind. Experiencing a thought and thinking a thought are two very different things. If I think my thought, it's generally up here. It says, I'm serious, believe me, do something about me, I'm important, now. What are you doing about this? Quick! If I experience the thought, then I experience it somewhere here. There's a chance that me experiencing the thought can hold more truth about a situation. It can hold the content of the thought. The thought has a content. It says something about me or the world or our relationship. Then it has a voice. You know, I can hear the pitch of it. It may be seductive. It may be, you know, smarmy. It may be gentle. It may be screaming. It may be whinging. Yeah, it can be all kinds of things. I can hear the pitch of voice and say, ooh, this is a kind of voice that I know for a long time. It's been talking to me for many, many years, and it's never content, whatever I do. Just by the sound of the voice, I can recognize this is not my friend, you know. There's somebody talking here who I cannot give my trust. It tells me to go and eat the ice cream, and then it tells me not to eat the ice cream. And then I go and eat the ice cream, and then it tells me I wouldn't have done that if I were you. If I don't eat the ice cream, it tells me, oh God, people who can't enjoy, really, they're no good. You know, renunciation only counts if you can enjoy. If you can't enjoy, renunciation doesn't count, really. So, he who doesn't enjoy is going to become bitter.
sour, joyless, wrinkled, shriveled up old piece of moralin. Yeah. So I know I can't trust this guy, because whatever I'm going to do, he's not going to make me happy. He doesn't allow me being happy. Now, if I experience a thought, I'm capable of understanding the nature of thought. I'm capable of understanding that thought arises. I do not know where thought arises from. Maybe you're different in this, but I don't honestly know where my thoughts come from. In fact, I have all reason to believe they're not my thoughts at all. They just pop up. Something slightly becomes more dense, and then at one point it becomes speakable, it becomes sayable. So there is a thought, and then it does its thing. It speaks to me. And then it goes. And I don't really know where it goes. Some of those thoughts I am glad that they go, and some of them I'm not glad that they go. Some of them seem to be recurring. Some of them seem to come and go and don't come back. Now, experiencing a thought means I am conscious that thought is a category of experience, and there are some universal characteristics to this category. They're conditioned. They're impermanent. They're dubious as to whom they belong. For some of them, I like them to belong to me, you know. If they're clever, I like to think, oh, it's a clever thought. This is my clever thought. I am a clever person. Clever thought is gone, but the clever person stays back. Yeah? That's very nice. And then a stupid thought comes, you know. I'm a stupid person. Stupid thought goes, the stupid person stays behind. Yeah? There's a problem in this process. If we cannot control the content of our thought, of our thinking, if we identify with that content, we'll be going to be miserable. Someday we're going to be happy, but you have probably experienced that the capacity to be miserable, disappointed, despondent, frustrated, angry, is a lot bigger than the propensity for a sustainable, consistent happiness. The capacity to be. Does anybody understand this? Propensity? Yeah. It's a tendency. Yeah. So chances are, if I'm going to be the content of my thinking, much of the time I'm going to be pretty useless. Because my thoughts are most of the time useless. Some of them are useful, and I like to be proud of those. But the truth is, most of them are not very useful. You know, some of them are just regurgitating what has happened last week. Some of them fantasizing a bit. The older I get, more memories come up. You know, I guess if you're young, you have more plans about the future, and if you get old, you have more memories about the past. But most of the thinking, if you look at what your mind is doing, is probably not going to be very useful. It's not necessarily wholesome, it doesn't necessarily make you happy, and it's probably not very useful. As brilliant and as necessary a faculty thinking is, also as dangerous is it. We can be easily slaves. If we transform the content of our thinking into who we are, a process Buddhist teaching calls upadana, attachment, grasping, then we have a problem. If the weather is good, we're good people, happy people. If the weather is bad, we're bad. Yeah. Now, since we cannot control the content of our thinking, we cannot base our notion of who we are on the content. Otherwise, we are going to be all over the place. We're going to be dragged all over the place. So the difference between having a thought and experiencing a thought is that experiencing the thought means I am conscious that this is something universal about thought. It's not just about me. I recognize thought as thought. This is a difference than being my thought. One of the things that helps us doing this is meditation. We learn to identify
the category of thought. In Buddhist meditation teaching, this is we could apply the Satipatthana teaching. It says this is the fourth Satipatthana, the raw material for the fourth foundation of mindfulness is patterned thought. It's content. It's the text line underneath the picture. Yeah. It's the running commentary on the universe. Yeah. Individuals base their existence on identification. One way of being individual means I distinguish myself in what I do and what I think and how I act from my context. That's the big thing on the Western shrine. The shrine of the Western psyche has on top of it the autonomous individual. That is its biggest project. That is what we worship most. Whether we believe in God or whether we believe in Buddha or not, but there is a distinctly individual take on our experience. If you've ever been to Asia, if you've lived there for a while, you will notice that the pattern of ego formation in the Western societies is based a lot more on individualistic notions. It is important that I am an individual, to some degree that I am autonomous. That makes us capable of a lot of things. We become more capable of having conflict. We're more capable of holding diversity. We are more capable of freeing, of emancipating ourselves from conditioning. That is a very, very important faculty. It is very necessary that I can hold my truth, even if he tells me that things are different. You know, if he tells me this is not the place to be afraid and I'm afraid, it is important for me to be able to say, to feel, and even to say I am afraid. Whatever he feels doesn't take me out of my experience. And it's important that we are capable of doing this, even if everybody tells us this is not a place to be afraid of, and we are afraid. It's necessary that we're capable of saying this, of owning our own truth. One of the things that individual teachings do is they enable us to do so. We become more independent, truly more independent. We become less identified with being member of a group, member of a religion, member of a collective, of a family, a clan, a tribe, a city. I think it is an indispensable stage of development. See, we human beings, as you know, are very dependent. One of the things that makes us specific in the world is that we have come to a stage evolutionary where as little human beings we're totally dependent primarily on a mother, but on a larger context, because she in turn is dependent on a larger context that holds her. Now little kangaroos, once they get born, you see, they're capable of crawling up mummy's legs and finding the bag, and then go in the bag and they find the tit, and then they know. They don't need a big society around them. They know how to get up mummy's hairy legs and find the nipple. Human beings don't work like that. They're coming to the world and they're totally helpless. You know, they can't move. They can't really crawl. It takes them a long time to start speaking. In fact, their brain development isn't finished. So one of the things that has really helped us to become that way is that we are relational. Human beings are capable of establishing social structures. And these social structures are totally indispensable. We need them to grow up the way we grow up. So we start with a level of total dependence on environment. And the problem with this is that this environment is going to influence us tremendously. If this environment is happy and sane and healthy and integrated, then human beings will have a good time. You know, they will gradually learn to distinguish their own needs from mommy's needs and so forth. But the chances are that this is not the case. Chances are that we mix these up. Mommy is not terribly happy and daddy is not terribly happy and maybe not there. And, you know, we end up with a story which isn't just our story. We end up with other people's stories. And yet we totally depend on them. So, you know, 10, 15 years later, it's very, very crucial for us to become separate, to become adolescent and go out of this unit that we have depended on to survive. So we start saying no, you know, very early. The moment a little kid starts to say no is generally a dramatic event in any family, you know, because this little word means the little one can stop whole family projects. Yeah,
no.
Yeah, it's a very crucial moment. I don't know when that happens developmentally, because I'm not a child psychologist, but I would think somewhere very shortly after the little one learns how to speak, you know, age two, the no becomes a dramatic experience. We learn to identify our needs. Mommy thinks, I need lots of spinach. I think, no. Yeah, that's a big crucial event, and mommy is maybe not going to like it. And I need to negotiate my particular experience with mommy's feelings around my particular experience. Yeah. Now, if I feel safe, I'm probably going to say no earlier, because I'm pretty sure she's not going to stop loving me if I say no. If I'm not feeling so safe, I may pretend I like it. Yeah. But still, I'm not going to like it. You know, just because I'm afraid to tell what I feel, it doesn't change actually the quality of my experience. It just changes the quality of my relationship to her. So obviously this would, you know, this could be pursued at great depth, but you'll understand, we grow in dependence of an environment that we cannot control. There is a stage in our life where it is important for us to find out who we are without that environment. This is always fraught with pain, with insecurity, with not knowing, with degrees of uncertainty. Once we have found out who we are, it is important that we join up again. You know, it is important that we identify common ground. Once we have found out what it is we want, we need, we aspire to, it is crucial to look over the fence and see who's out there, you know, who else is out there, who else is in my park. And there's something in the Western psyche that gets stuck somewhere in between these stages. Now, most of the Buddhists I know are people who have successfully managed to emancipate themselves from the first sort of garden they have grown up in. I have a lot of monastic history, so in monastic communities this is even stronger. The people who end up in Buddhist monasteries are generally people with an over-average resistance to society conditioning, because otherwise they would have become Jews or Christians or, you know, whatever. But since they end up in a Buddhist community, and since they're Western people, generally they must have something has happened in their lives which has made them choose differently than what their context would have encouraged them to. Because I'm not sure about your parents, but my parents certainly didn't encourage me to become a Buddhist, and they didn't definitely not encourage me to become a Buddhist monk. In fact, they thought this was not really a happy thing. This was just a little bit better than becoming a heroin addict for some. So, people ending up in Buddhist communities are generally very good at being individuals. They're very good at saying no to things. Yeah. You want me to become this? No. You want me to go there? No. You want me to believe that? No. Yeah.
And that is interesting, and suddenly they end up being a community again, yeah? After having said no to many things and having found their own ways of understanding, of looking, of living, of holding their relationship, they end up in a group of people again, and they find that not easy. One of the biggest learning lessons in my life has been being a member of a monastic community. Yeah, this is image, the rishi image. Yeah, some people have archetypal myths. So you become a monk, and some people have the myth of being a rishi, a Hindu sadhu, you know, alone somewhere out there on his rock, meditating with his trident and his tea kettle. Yeah. A lone meditator, a lone ascetic, eating little, sleeping little, talking to nobody, just doing it all on himself. That is indeed, you know, in religious history there's an archetype of this. Christian tradition, Syrian desert fathers, up to the Christian mythology, Indian tradition very strongly, whole ascetic tradition starting a little before the Buddha. There's plenty of so-called religious historical evidence for this role. Western people are often attracted by this. Now, given our individualist notions, given our individualist background, you know, it is no surprise to me that we latch onto this image of the lonely meditator. We latch on to this very individual take. I'm going to do it myself. Me on my cushion with my meditation object. Yeah, I'm finding my way out alone. This is not surprising to me that communities or individuals that have come out of a culture that is encouraging individualism, independence, autonomy, self-sufficiency, self-responsibility, all this type of thing Western culture has for a long time encouraged, at least for the last 250 years. It is no surprise to me that when they go out east and look what's happening there, that they have their individualist glasses on, you see? All the things they see are individualist teachings. They don't think this is the problem with the glasses. They think it's out there, you know? What they see is individualist Buddhism. So they come back with one meditation cushion, one meditation mat, one meditation object, yeah, or a technique. They think this is it, this is the kit, you know, I can do it on my own. But the truth is, even in a monastery, they're totally communal. I know no monastery that consists of only caves and individual monks. In fact, you can't live like that. It takes many, many years of practice before you can live like that on your own, before you have enough inner strength to actually sustain a practice on your own. Most of monastic life is about community. So imagine you have a whole heap of individuals thinking of themselves as individuals, having an individual notion of what practice consists of, and then everyday life is community. You know, morning till evening, they run together, monastery, they work together, they meditate together, they eat together, they chant together, they live by a monastic discipline that not just presupposes community, but actually that only makes sense if there are other people who are doing what you're doing. If you look at monastic discipline, and I've looked quite a bit at this, there's many books of it, and it's very interesting what's in there. On one hand, you have the rules. This is the smallest part. This is obvious. Rules are rules. They are normative. But then you have the stories which have led to the rules. Usually a rule has become a rule because lay people have complained to the Buddha about the behavior of his monks. Later, when he had nuns, they have complained about the behavior of his nuns. But initially, the Buddha didn't give a set of rules. What he gave is a teaching. The rules came about, usually 80% of the rules came about because people at the time of the Buddha had a vague, not defined but clearly felt sense of what spiritual people were about. And when Buddha's monks were not living by what lay people felt, they complained to the Buddha.
The Buddha then called the monk and says, well, have you really done this? You know, are you really storing food? Or do you really have 15 pieces of robe, you know, when you only allowed three? You know, how do you... So after the complaint of the lay people has been confronted with the monk, generally the monk has admitted something. And then the Buddha has given a guideline how this is to be held. You shouldn't have 15 pieces of robe, three pieces is enough. They shouldn't be 10 meters long, they should be so big, so wide. Yeah. So there you have a rule, and in the rule you have a whole story of implicit values. You know something, you learn something about how these people live, what they used, how their family structure was. All this is very interesting material in the monastic discipline. You get a feeling for the time, you get a feeling for the culture, the society. So if you look at this monastic rule, you become aware how crucial living together is. And most of what it deals around about is how to live together in a harmonious way, in a way that supports introspection. It supports how you understand yourself more deeply and how you understand your relationship to others more deeply. Now, my experience is that Western people are very interested in introspective techniques and understanding ourselves more deeply. And so we meditate. And then we stop meditating and we continue thinking about ourselves in the old patterns. Yeah, we do one thing, meditation, and then meditation stops. Then we either translate the insights we have had in meditation, we translate back into an old model of thinking about ourselves, me and others, to give a good example. Individualistic models, me against the rest of the world. Do you have days in your life where it feels this is a battle, you against the rest of the universe? You have such days. I still have such days.
Are there other days?
Is there somebody else out there? You it's just me against the Martians. So a good deal of insight can be gained from looking at the value the Buddha has given to ways of relating to other beings. Yeah. That's an interesting aspect. As you recall, Buddha calls his teaching, he calls it Dhamma Vinaya. He doesn't just call it Dhamma, he calls it Dhamma Vinaya. And Vinaya is that which leads out. Yeah, vineti means to lead out. And Vinaya obviously is also the term for the whole monastic discipline. It is that which enables conduct. It is that which enables how we relate to material things, to vital energies, to other people, to institutions. It puts us in context, to put it simply. While the Dhamma says something about the generic nature of experience, it says something about the grand scale of things. Vinaya often informs us of the way we relate. As you know, there are various aspects of the Buddhist teaching. Two big pillars of this Buddhist teaching are, one is the teaching on impersonality, the teaching on anatta. This is not an easy teaching, as you will know, and much of the way we ascertain this teaching in our lives is analytical. We look at something and we decide there is no self in there. We look at something else and we decide there is no self. We look at something else and decide there is no self. We proceed analytically. The other side of the Buddhist teaching is about conditions, or specifically about dependent origination, about how things connect with each other, what things lead to what other things. Yeah. So the first type of teaching
brings us into an analytical mode. We take things apart. We take things apart. We unravel. We undo. Things get smaller and smaller and smaller. The other aspect of the teaching is just synthetical. We look how things hang together. You know, which conditions are happening because of what conditions? What do these conditions lead to? Things become more complex, bigger and bigger and bigger, and everything hangs together. In both of these approaches have their good use, and both of them have their problems, as you may know. If we take things apart too much, they will become more substantial. They get smaller and smaller and smaller, and they become more substantial. So they become to be more solid. Just by the method of understanding the things, they become more solid. There's a solidification. Analysis always brings you little bits at the end of the day. Yeah? You get smaller and smaller bits, which you don't know where they belong to. It's chopped up fine, and it seems to become more solid in the process. At the end, you have very kind of fine little atomistic stuff, and you don't really know where it belongs. Yeah? A good example is Abhidhamma. If you look at the Abhidhamma teaching, yeah, some aspects of the Abhidhamma teaching, at the end of it, you were hunting Rupa Kalapanas, and you don't really know what that means anymore in terms of your experience. The other side, you know, synthetic, how things hang together, what leads to what, complexity of things, things become bigger and bigger and bigger, and everything hangs together with everything else, and you don't really know what to do anymore. Yeah, you lose, either it's overwhelming to you, that's one aspect. Some people just feel, what shall I do with this? Other people find that very inspiring. Yeah, you move one little thing here, and then everything else over there moves. They say, well, let's pray to it. Yeah, that's one aspect. We worship it. Wonderful. Interdependence. Perfect. Wonderful. On my knees, I pray to it. Yeah. At the end of it, it leaves you with something which you do not know how it relates to your immediate experience. Both process, analysis and synthesis, will lead you in the end to something that you cannot really reconcile with your immediate experiential qualities, with what you feel, believe, taste, touch. Yeah. So it's crucial that these two things always go together. Now, Buddhist philosophy has understood that. Sometimes, you know, you look through the centuries, one school has a bit much more of this, the other school has a bit much more of that, and usually they've criticized each other for this. So, and with that criticism, there's a sort of swing back. You see that through the history of Buddhist teaching. It's crucial to understand this. I think today, I don't think we have a dominant tendency. We have probably individual preferences for such tendencies. You will probably find that you have an individual preference for one or the other method.
You gave examples for the dissecting the things, yeah. Going down to the, like finding the little things.
Atoms, yeah.
Yeah. But can you give an example for the other thing of going to the big picture?
The other thing is obviously something like you look how something comes to exist. So you find out what are the reasons for it to exist. You find out these reasons also have reasons. A good example would be, the worst example for me personally, is something like Hegel's philosophy. Yeah? The identification of the state as the subject that moves from thesis to antithesis and finds synthesis. And at the end of it, he identified the national state with that subject. History is the process of antithetical movement. So all you can do is just basically wait and see if it works out. And you don't know what to do. Mystic tradition has said, you know, God is wonderful. He's manifest in all things. Isn't this perfect? You can't really do anything about it anymore. It's perfect. Any monist religion will do that. Monism as such does that. Advaita Vedanta does it. You know, some forms of Christian teachings do it. You end up in a position where you can either reject it and say this is all bad, or you say this is all wonderful, it's all good. But in any way, you cannot do anything. You have no power anymore because conditions are so complex, so big. There's contemporary examples of this. Butterfly theory, you know, remember?
But in our practice, because you, for the little thing you did mention, a specific practice of some Buddhism.
Analytical practice. Well, obviously, dependent origination is an example of a synthetic practice. Now, if you look at dependent origination as a way to explain the world, you end up with a world that becomes further and further removed from your immediate experience. You think, what can I do? What can I do? You know, look at world politics, and you see people that have most power, they behave most like children. Yeah? When I'm going to have a problem with your country, first thing I do is I move my ambassador back. Yeah? I switch back from the most comprehensive way of negotiating with you, of having your people, your skilled and intelligent people, to talk with my intelligent people. So you do something nasty, I do something nasty. I take my people back. We stop talking. Yeah? Then I cut your most favorite economic status. Then I'm going to move my aircraft carriers in front of your waters. Yeah? You know, I go from actually intelligent talking to symbolic gestures. In terms of human development, I go from adult back to sandpit demonstration. I'm going to take your toy if you take my toy. And if you're going to hit my sandcastle, I'm going to hit your sandcastle. And if you're a little bit stronger, I have a bigger brother that will do it for me. Yeah? So this is a kind of simplistic way. Now, if you look at world politics, there's something in me that goes helpless. You know, I come from a democratic background, but I'm conscious democracy is very slow. And democracy can sometimes be very faint-hearted and not effective. And it can do horrible mistakes. It can be not caring. It can say, well, this is bad, but really we can't do much. We're a small country and we don't have much. We don't believe in weapons and we don't have much power. And you have to resolve that for yourself. We did our work, so now you do your work. This kind of thing. So I'm conscious of how little power we sometimes have. One of the things that I'm always frightened of is helplessness. And one of the way of not feeling helpless is saying, well, I'm not really caring. I don't really care. I don't really look. Yeah? One way of not feeling helpless is making my world small. Yeah? When I'm back at my keyboard, yeah, on the computer, then I'm the king. You know, the world is mine. I can switch on, I can switch off. I make this, and then it makes bang. Yeah? Wonderful thing. It's a safe world. I can be God on my computer. Almost. Sometimes not. It doesn't work. But yeah. It's very controllable. It's predictable. I can install. I can say yes. I can say no. I can say this color, that color. Yeah. But the world gets bigger. Yeah. Already family is bigger. You can't really switch on and off. Yeah. Community, city, even more bigger. You have all kinds of people in there. Countries is really bad. Yeah, it's really bad. I mean, you know something here, isn't it, in this country? You have all kinds of stories here going on. So you realize how helpless you can feel in a place you're responsible. So one way of reducing feeling helpless is making your responsibility small. Say, I don't look, I don't care, I don't hear, you know. Remember the three elephants, the three monkeys? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see, I don't hear, I don't say. That's one way of avoiding helplessness. One way of not relating. What I'm doing, this is a long preamble for the value of relationship. See, if we are analytical, we don't actually relate. If we are too synthetical, we also don't relate. Both the making things, taking things apart, trying to find units, will give us the illusion of finding an essence. you know, something substantial, something solid, the rock bottom of world.
Yeah.
We believed there are certain particles. Then we found out that these particles actually consist of further particles. Now we found out these particles consist of even further subparticles. And we found out that they consist of basically of nothing, you know. They consist of a certain type of behavior. But there isn't really something there. Even physics seems to admit this. There isn't really something there. If you go to the other side, you look at interconnectedness. Say something like an environmental habitat, a whole environment. You realize everything is affected by everything else. You kill that little bug and suddenly this animal dies. If that animal dies, these birds will become really rampant. If those birds become rampant, your crops go away because everything is being eaten up. If you keep doing this long enough, you know, your glaciers will retreat or will start out and your atmosphere is going to go off, you know. There's all kind of, and you sit here and you think, well, while we sit here and trying to meditate, the whales are dying off, the polar caps are melting, the Amazon rainforest is being sold off, you know, the Indonesians are chopping everything and turning it into toilet paper, you know, and what can I do about all this? You end up helpless again. And where am I going to do? Am I going to save the whales and then the, you know, and then the Palestinians are going to go funny, or am I going over to get this Palestinian thing sorted out, and then the whales are going off and the forest goes off and the polar caps are melting, and, you know, where is my role? What can I do? Where am I having some choice in the matter? So both of these methods can bring us to despair. In both ways, we end up basically not relating properly. Because if I can't do anything because it's too big, I'm just going to shrivel. I'm just going to go back to my conditioning. If it's too small for it to have any substance to my relationship, I'm also not caring. And that's one of the big problems with individualism, is our willingness to not care. You see, our capacity to say no to our environment, to be different from where we come from, to not believe what we are told. One of the difficulties with this is that we stop relating. Buddhist teaching has two cardinal virtues, you're conscious. One of them, obviously, is wisdom. It's the capacity to understand, because only through understanding this heart will become free. But it takes a long time till we understand, and this understanding sinks down into the heart. Because we can understand first many things before we can really live from that understanding. My heart is a lot slower than my head. Now, the understanding that makes me free is not an understanding that comes from the head. It generally goes through there, but it takes some time to sediment. It needs to sink down till I can live from that. The other side of Buddhist teaching, which is very crucial, is karuna. It's compassion. And compassion is not something that we feel for those poor things out there somewhere. Compassion is the ability to go into resonance. It's the capacity to feel. There's an older word than compassion in the Buddhist teaching, which is not very well known. The word is called anukampa. In fact, in early Buddhism, the Buddha often uses that term. And when we translate that term, it is very clear what compassion is. Kampati means to tremble. And anukampati means to tremble along with somebody or with something. It means that this heart is capable of trembling with others. It's capable of resonating with other people. The Tibetan tradition sometimes translates karuna, or the workings of Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, as bearing the suffering of others so that you are doing everything to minimize the suffering. It is not to take other suffering away, but you go along with their suffering. You are allowing this suffering to happen to yourself. And because of that, because you sense that suffering, not as an indirect pity, yeah, you poor things down there, but eye level, yeah, on you meet the suffering of another on eye level, and because of that, you are acting. Very crucial to understand, karuna, compassion, is not a passive quality. Notice, in the Tibetan iconography, is very, very clear. Wisdom aspects are always female. That's interesting, isn't it? And the compassion aspect, which Western culture would probably lump in much more with the female, is masculine. No? Avalokiteshvara, in the Tibetan tradition, is masculine. It, grammatically, he's masculine, and also the depiction of him. If you look at him, he not just has a lotus bead, in his hand, or a rosary. He's also got bow and arrow, hatchet, you know. It's compassionate action. It's an active quality. It's not something that we just feel terribly concerned, yeah? And we wait till the UN resolution is passed or so. It's not. It's something that is capable of an act. It's capable of reaching out, of doing something. So, I have a little program, or I have a... And this program comes from having been an introspective Buddhist meditator for many years. And I, living in a community of people who also think they're introspective Buddhist individual meditators, I have come to understand that it is very, very crucial that we form groups, that we acknowledge common or communal needs, aspirations, fears, that we acknowledge not just the individual nature of our experience, but that we acknowledge the communal, the aspect of our experience. Now, you see, when you learn to meditate, in many ways, I think for many years I have tried within myself to establish universal characteristics of experience. We take this world we experience very personal. That's one of the aspects of individual, the individual blueprint in our mind, is we take everything very deeply personal. Now the truth is, there isn't really very much personal if you look at us from the big schemes. We get born like many other people get born. We grow up like most other people grow up. We have our first love affairs. We struggle with our parents. We finally establish our own existence. We consolidate this existence. We find out that some of the things we started off with are completely wrong. We make big changes and alterations. We live on. We establish new relationships, new professional contexts. We go on. And at some point we die. Yeah. Now in the process of this, we experience a degree of happiness, experience a degree of suffering. You notice that sometimes what we think about our happiness or about our suffering doesn't really matter that much, because the same things happen to us, and one time you're happy, the next time we're not happy with it. Or you notice people differ. For some people, this is a lot of happiness. For other people, this doesn't even start to get good at that stage. You know, they want that much. So our interpretation of what happens is one ball game. But if you actually look, the rudiments, the raw material of our experience isn't so personal. It isn't, you know. At any moment of your life, you're not really alone. You know, even when you got born, there were thousands of others who got born at the same second, and when you die, thousands of others will die at the same second. So there is something profoundly universal about our experience, and yet we take it all very, very personal. And I tell you, there is truth in this. You know, there is an aspect of our experience that is perfectly personal and unique and irrevocable. Once It comes and then it goes and it's gone. It's unique. It's precious. It's specific. It's particular, and it has something to do with just us. But there is also an aspect of our experience which is totally common, which is totally shared. It's generic. And much of my early meditation training was about getting away from the model of being specific, unique, particular, special, me, or particularly mine.
Yeah.
Getting away from that model and establishing the generic nature of experience. This is a thought. Whatever this thought says, thousands of thoughts have come, thousands of thoughts will probably come, and it will go where the other thoughts have gone. What does it change? What is so significant about this thought? You know, it's coming of dubious origins, it moves, it changes while it is there, it has a kind of message, then it goes, disappears. Every thought does that. Now, many of my thoughts say, I'm important, believe me, do something about me, I'm the end of all thought. Yeah? And none of them has been. You know, they all have a very common nature. Most of them have a habit of multiplying, you know. I have kind of rabbit thoughts, you know. One rabbit, a second rabbit, and then suddenly 15 million rabbits, yeah? You have such things? They have a tendency to multiply. Buddhist teaching calls that papancha. It's a very common experience. It's the explosive associative pattern fanning out of cognitive activity. The short word for this in Buddhist psychology is papancha. It means, could call it one good translation for it is conceptual proliferation. It spreads, it sprawls, yeah? And it's crucial to understand the nature of thought. Something's running over this roof here. I wonder what that is. So it's crucial to understand the nature of thought, not just the content of thought. And it takes a lot of exercise to not be hypnotized by the content of thought and actually establish what thought does, what it cannot do. Now, the way I've been brought up and trained, I respond with cognitive activity to everything. I'm afraid, I think. I'm happy, I think. I'm sad, I think. I'm angry, I think. Now that generally goes, if I'm angry, then there is, the first thing of anger is generally a bodily experience. Somewhere a pressure in the pit of my stomach, it's diffuse, it's heat, it is expansive, it's unpleasant. Now my general way of defending against this is I go up. Yeah? My attention from here where it is unpleasant, I shift to here, where apparently there is more control. Yeah? A very standard classic defense. You know, we become cognitive, you know, from being sense-based in our experience, from being capable of holding a heart-level connection. If things go wrong there, I become more cognitive, I become more thinking. I distance myself from the unpleasant quality of this experience by thinking about it. Now this is fine if I think about the Buddhist teaching and I think about the unnecessary quality of anger or the dangerous potential that is in anger, or if I think such things, this may be useful, this may be an effective strategy to get away from my unpleasant anger experience. But the truth is, most of the time when I'm angry here and I go up, I don't think about how bad anger is. I think about other things that have made me angry, or I think about what this person has done 3 days ago to me and again she's doing it. Yeah. So the effect of this is, because I come from anger, my thinking circles around things that have made me angry.
Yeah.
So instead of making this unpleasant experience more easy and cooling it down by giving it the perspective that I could theoretically have with my head, I actually think about things that have made me angry or that will make me angry or that have made me 30 years angry or that this person always makes me angry. Yeah? So it has the opposite effect. Instead of becoming more quiet and more calm and getting a bigger perspective, I get sucked into, by my memory patterns, into a deeper feeding of this angry sensation. Now, anger, like all things in the world, is impermanent. You can't really stay angry very long. It's impossible to stay angry really long unless you keep thinking about things that have made you angry. Yeah? Now, if your anger doesn't go away in 60 seconds or so, then obviously you're feeding it somehow. You see? Because things go away really quickly. Emotions don't last very long if we don't feed them. So the structure of de-identification is a crucial task in meditation exercise. Yeah, we learn that the thoughts do not belong to us. The thoughts belong to some bigger process of which we are part of, which we don't quite understand, and a process which we don't help if we identify with an individual thought. Take the thought out and make it mine. That's what identification is. On the level of thinking, identification or upadana means I believe that the content of this experience, of this thinking, is me. On the level of heart, it means I want to keep it or I don't want to keep it. Yeah. Grasping on the level of heart means, oh, let it stay that way, or let's go away. Yeah. This is a crucial principle, and we need to learn to find out how we do this. Yeah? So, this process of identification with, particularly with thoughts, is something that can prolong our states, our emotional states, very seriously. It could also do the opposite. It can help us get this into perspective. And that's what you do in meditation practice. You try to get it into perspective. This is anger, and it's conditioned. It will have its conditions for it to come. Some of those conditions may have to do with the environment, but there is in myself a readiness to jump into anger. A latent potential for anger is happening here. As long as I'm not acknowledging this, I will keep blaming outside. Something hurts here, who's to blame? It's her fault. Yeah. As long as I do this, spiritual practice doesn't really get anywhere. Because we keep looking for guilty persons outside. We keep blaming our quality of experience on circumstances or on people. So meditation practice helps you to own up. It helps you to become responsible. It says, there is anger, okay. There is anger. It feels that way. Rather than say, what makes me angry? How could I take revenge? How can I stop this? Can this be somehow stopped? Yeah. This shouldn't be. Do you know this voice in yourself? Indignation. This isn't allowed. He's not allowed to do this. We haven't spoken about this. You know, stop him. Take him away. Lock him up. Shoot him. Yeah. So this is the response. This is what in Buddhist psychology is called dosha. It's aversion, hatred, anger. It's this type. It's rejection. I don't want to have anything to do with this. The other aspect is I like it. Oh, that's nice. More of it, please. Yes, now. Lots of it. No, all of it. Yeah. this side is simply called lobha. Yeah, it's greed, taking, wanting. These are two movements of mind which define much of our experience. Every moment of our experience, every event of our experience has this quality. If we are careful enough to look, if our mindfulness gets clear enough to look, we will identify any moment that we have attraction and repulsion in our mind. You know, like a little amoeba, you know, long before it does complicated things like breathing oxygen or having sexuality or anything, long before any such development has taken place, it knows two things. It knows going towards and going away from. A basic fundamental principle of life, yeah. It doesn't really get much more simple than an amoeba, you know. Stringing together a few amino acids and you got it. That's about it. And the whole thing is basically irritable. It knows a principle called irritability. It can be excited. Now certain things it likes. Certain things it likes, it goes towards. And certain things it doesn't like, it goes away from. Yeah? Now in the mind, am I clear? In the mind there is a similar principle. There's something, any moment, if you're paying careful attention to what's happening in your heart, you will notice there's a certain like this, don't like this, like this, don't like this. This happens all the time. And that's not intrinsically bad. The problem with this is that the things we like, they get a lot of awareness, and the things we don't like, we pull back, yeah? We go out. We don't want to look, we don't want to feel, we don't want to think, we don't want to hear, we don't want to sense. So this little movement, liking and not liking, decides the quality and the area where our attention goes. That's very crucial. And one of the things we establish in meditation practice is we try to unclutch our attention from liking and not liking. Unclutch is what you do in the car when you shift gear. Yeah, you press the clutch, then you change the gear. You try to separate the fact that you give attention from the quality of liking or not liking. So in meditation you say, I'm being attentive not because I like it, but because it's there. I am trying to be unbiased in my attention. I don't just favor one aspect of experience, I favor whatever is there. If what is there is pleasant, I stay with the pleasant. If what is there is unpleasant, I stay with the unpleasant. If it's boring, I stay with the boring. You understand? Now you realize this is difficult. You sit here, why does the mind wander? Why does it go away from the breath? It goes away from the breath because it is attracted to something else. It is attracted to a thought. It is attracted to a sound. It is attracted to a memory. It is attracted to a fantasy. Why is this so? It is so because the fantasy holds more pleasure, or it holds more pain, because that's the tragic thing about us. We are not just attracted to pleasant things. We also identify with unpleasant things. In fact, I am sure you will recognize many of us are attracted to unpleasant things. Somehow, some way, we have learned that we are not just good people. We are quite willing to admit that we are also bad people. Stupid people, mean people, stingy people, nasty people, irresponsible people, lazy people, yeah? People are quite, you know, sometimes it's very difficult for us to acknowledge actually the goodness. One of the problems in the Western psyche, and please verify, maybe Israeli people are different from that, is that people are quite willing to say that they're not good. They admit that. They don't like it, but they admit it. In fact, they secretly believe they're not good. And they have difficulty admitting the goodness in their own hearts. The Dalai Lama was very moved. In fact, he was moved to tears when he was told this, that people find it difficult to have loving kindness for themselves. One of the real difficulties in the Western psyche is to actually love oneself. Yeah. How can I love this self if I think it's a bad self. If I'm attached to the notion that this is a bad, this is somehow bad, I'm not going to like it. I'm not going to love it. And that's one of the biggest challenges in the Western psyche, is acknowledging the goodness in ourselves and actually growing. That makes our relationship so difficult, is because I'm a deeply bad self and you love me. How can I respect you for loving a bad person? Or I'm interested in abusing you, you know, because I think of myself so badly, I need you to tell me that I'm such a lovable, good person. And when you start giving off the slightest sign that you don't really think I'm all the time very good, I'm really in trouble, because you were the person I relied upon telling me that I'm good, although actually deep down I think I'm bad. That makes you so attractive to me, because you tell me the opposite and that feels really good, and then you have something to tell me that doesn't make me look good. You know, then my last support starts going away. This is really threatening to my psyche. That's why relationships are so difficult. So, identification, crucial topic. We learn in meditation to establish the generic quality of our experience. What is universal about my body? Is my liver really personal? Does it think it's my liver? Does it do something different? Is a Akinchana's liver really more personal than Rennie's liver, you know? How much does Rennie's liver think this is Rennie's liver? Or does it just think it's a liver? Or does it not think it's a liver at all? Does it just do its business? The same, you know. Well, liver is reasonably personal still, you know. But how about your fingernails? Your fingernails, you clip them off, no longer your fingernails, isn't it? Where is that me that is so intrinsic? I lost a bit of tooth the other day. You know, where is that? Is some bit of me gone, or what is this? Am I less now? Yeah. We have strange notions about our body. We have strange notions about how we relate to our experience. We breathe air. Once the air is inside, you know, it's me. The air is outside, it's me. Is it Palestinian air, or is it Israeli air? Is it Armenian air, or is it Swiss, German air? Somehow, it doesn't work like that, isn't it? We all know. And yet, it feels very, very personal. I need air. I need a certain degree of oxygen in there. I am dependent completely on breathing. And yet, there's something totally impersonal about this. If I don't get enough air, very soon, this personal life is going to stop. We know that. We've learned that, we've experienced it. And yet, actually, it's totally impersonal. Any air will do, you know. Ramallah air will do as well as Kandersteg air, or as Jerusalem air, or as London air, or as Baghdad air. Any air will do, you know. It doesn't need a specific air. It needs a generic type of air, and any air can do that. There's many of our needs that are generic. You know, some things like mothering. Mothering is something anybody really can do. You don't need to be clever. You don't need to be white. You don't need to be pretty. You don't need to be healthy. You know, in some ways, it's such a fundamental need. We all totally depend on this. And yet, it can be given by anybody who is willing and attuned enough to do that. So we have to rejuggle the relationship between the personal and the universal. Many years in meditation practice, we establish firmly the universal nature of our experience. We establish, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. The big mantra in early Buddhism. Whatever I think, whatever I feel, whatever I smell, whatever I taste, whatever I touch, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. We establish the impersonal nature of our experience. We establish the universal quality. Impermanence is universal. The Buddha didn't say many, many things about the world out there, but a couple of things he said. One of the things he says, it's changing. It's uncertain. The Thai teacher Ajahn Chah always referred to impermanence as uncertainty. You don't know. You cannot predict. The other quality is, it at some point, it is mixed with suffering. It is unsatisfactory. It's crucial to understand the term suffering broad. It means anything we can experience through our six senses is mixed up with unsatisfactoriness. However good it tastes, however long it lasts, however exquisite it is, there is some unsatisfactoriness in there. Different types of unsatisfactory. Some things are just downright painful. Other things are unsatisfactory because we need to put in a lot of effort to maintain it. Other things are unsatisfactory because they have the nature to change into their opposite. There's different layers of unsatisfactoriness, and this is a profound teaching. But inevitably, everything we can experience is in some way mixed up with unsatisfactoriness. The second thing that the Buddha said. The third thing he said, it's impersonal. It's not the self. So we establish these three characteristics of experience when we meditate. This is what we call vipassana, strictly speaking. Vipassana, strictly speaking, is not an exercise. The vipassana movement has it wrong on that count. It's not a technique, it's not a method, it's not an exercise. What the Buddha calls vipassana is the insight, it's the fruit of the exercise, it's not the exercise itself. Having actually an insight into the impersonal nature of our experience, into the intrinsic unsatisfactoriness of experience, into the fundamental change that is hallmark of all our experience, that is vipassana. Once we have this insight, that is vipassana. That is what makes us change our lives. That is what makes us change our goals. The problem with establishing the universal category of our experience is that it leaves us preoccupied with an introspective technique. It leaves us preoccupied with that part of us that still identifies with thinking, feeling, tasting, touching, viewing as personal. And while we are preoccupied with introspective techniques to understand that, we are not communal. We sit on our cushions. The whales are dying. The polar caps are melting. You know, the struggle isn't over. What are we going to do about it? What place does the relational part of our lives have while we are preoccupied with establishing internal evidence of anicca, of dukkha, of anatta? And there is a time when we have to come back into a communal world, when we have to come back into a sangha, when we have to come back into a community. We cannot wait until we're enlightened before we start acting again, before we start caring again. You see? It's a difficult task. There's one idea which says, you know, life is short, because life is short and we are mortal, some things are more important than others. So let's establish priorities. Yeah. If I had all time in the world, I could do all things in the world. I needn't choose. But since it looks like I'm not going to have all time in the world, some things seem more urgent. What are these things? You know, establishing values, big topic. You can't do that in meditation practice. You need to think for that. You know, some things you cannot do by just sitting there following your breath. Some things you have to actually ask yourself, okay, I gained some clarity sitting there following my breath. Now what I do with this clarity? Where do I go? What choices do I make? Where do my vital energies go? my money, my strength, my time, my sexuality. What do these things do? We need to think about these things. It's not enough to just do our business and then meditate and then go into our business again. You understand? There has to be some connection between these two. Obviously, what we get in our meditation has something to do with how we live. It doesn't just have to do with what technique you use. That also has something to do with it. But largely, what happens in your meditation speaks of what happens in your life. And if what happens in your meditation isn't to your satisfaction, then maybe some of the reasons for that has to do with the way you live your life. So we need to rethink our life in terms of what's happening in our meditation. Yeah? We need to take what we gain in our meditation back into our lives. And that means back into our relationship, because you're never alone. You know, even if you're alone, you're not alone. It's me in relationship to something. The fundamental unit of experience is two, it's not one. That's the thing that's wrong with individualism. You are not just some kind of protrusion into the universe. You know, everything is in relationship. Even if you're allowed out alone in the Negev, you're still in relationship. You cannot experience without a type of duality happening. Every sense organ provides us with the feeling that there's something happening out here and there's somebody in there. That's a relationship. That relationship has something to do how you have grown up. It has something to do with how you will relate to real human beings in your life. So we need to take the meditational part, what we have established, how we are with ourselves, and look at it how we are with others. Much of Buddhist practice is about how we are with others. Because you see, self is not just a little cognitive problem, a belief that we can just unhinge and then it's fine. Self is a process. It'd be better to speak of selfing rather than of self. Selfing is a habit. Selfing is what we do when we say, this is my thought. I have a copyright on this. This is a good thought. I like it. I'm going to write it down. Maybe I'm going to sell it. Or this is a bad thought. I don't want it. I'm not going to say anything about it to anybody. That's selfing. This is my time. This is my life. This is my world. This is my movie. Don't be in my movie. You know. Go, get out of my movie. This is selfing. You understand? So this we do all the time. We do it with ourselves. There's not one person in here. There's many people in there. I don't know how it is in your heart, but in here there's many of them. And sometimes they're nice, you know, they sit at the table and they behave. They say, well, actually, this is what I think. And the other says, this is what I think. And we need to talk about this. I don't quite agree with you. Yeah? They do this. And sometimes they're kind of like this. They say, you don't exist. Yeah? They say, I'm the only one here. Then the other one comes and pushes this one aside and says, I'm the only one here. Yeah? So we enact relationships in here. And obviously what's happening in here is we do out here, with him and with her and with her. If you understand conditionality properly, you will understand that what you do to yourself, you will do to your world. Your world is your friend, is your mom, is your lover, is your kids. You continually enact a type of relationship that you hold with yourself, with the world. That is not just a problem, it's also a learning opportunity. It means the world continually feeds back what you are doing to yourself anyway. Now, if the Third World War happens in here, you'll be assured the Third World War happens at your breakfast table, with your love, you know, or with your job, or with your mates, or with your whoever. So, that leaves us with relationship as a legitimate object of contemplative inquiry. What I do with my own experience, quote unquote, I can do, in fact, I need to do with the relationships I live in. They become objects of Dhamma practice, they become objects of investigation. It's worthy to establish what's happening, what type of relationships do you have, what patterns are occurring, what are you doing with others, what do you feel they do with you. You know, anything that repeats itself is suspicious.
Yeah.
Remember, like the anger, if it stays for longer than a couple of moments, you are somehow engaging with it. You are somehow responsible for an aspect of it. Now, this is not easy, because I like to say this is nothing to do with me. If it's not pleasant, it's yours, it's not mine. Sorry, dear, your problem, not mine. Back to the newspaper. Yeah. So, I like to stop here. We will have a chance to go a little bit more deeper. I would like to become more specific about some aspects of the Buddhist teaching which may help with this, but I think we have a patch of work. Relationship as the basis of community, but also relationship as the fundamental pattern in how we relate to ourselves. The non-separateness of how we are with our own experience and how we are with real existing other human beings. There is something in there that I like to stress. And obviously, a major culprit, a major black sheep in this process is what the Buddha calls identification. Me grasping at elements of my experience, be they pleasant or unpleasant. So much in a nutshell. I'd like to stop here for a moment and open up for question or for a break or for a stretch. I'm aware it's heating up and it's time. Let's stretch a moment and then come back, yeah?